Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get it going here on Diamond Conversations, being brought to you today here on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week we sit down to have a Diamond Conversation. And this time it's no different as we welcome in a awesome guest, somebody I'm very excited to have joining us today. He's a 1986 World Series champion New York Met. He is the one and only Mr. Barry Lyons joining Diamond Conversations today. Mr. Lyons, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Ian. Good to be on with you guys.
We're thrilled to have you. And of course, joining us is the producer, co-host extraordinaire, Mr. Doug Barclay in the seat in the middle. And we're going to talk about a little baseball today. We're going to talk about some things about your life and all the things going on in between. But, you know, more than ever, it's like I said, it's great to have you. And bravo for being the first 86 Met to join the show.
Well, I'm honored. A great team, obviously, and I was a bit part on that team, but thankful to be a part of the Mets organization those years, and certainly excited to talk about Mets baseball and my career and my life in baseball. So I appreciate you guys reaching out to me and invite me on with you.
Oh, absolutely. And trust me, you're in good company as it relates to the Met fan, because you could say whatever it was as Met fans. I remember watching those games. I remember Barry Lyons very, very well. So you're in good company today. But before we get into all that and all the cool stuff that you did in your playing days, let's kind of talk about what's going on now. I was able to catch two really well done informational little documentaries about you as we're preparing for the interview, and it changes kind of the whole dynamic of what you want to talk about, because I really want to learn more about kind of what you've been up to, put your post-career, things going on in your life. I've been able to listen to your testimony on some of the different outlets you've appeared on, and it's a wonderful thing to hear what you've got to say. So kind of tell the listeners what it is you've been doing the last couple of years.
Well, I thank you, Ian. That baseball has certainly been a key part of my life and something I'm very proud of and thankful for, and reaching the ultimate goal. My childhood dream of being a Major League Baseball player was obviously an amazing accomplishment that I'm so thankful to have been able to achieve. But yeah, I was the player that performed and took all the steps and eventually made it to the big leagues. But I had a lot of people supporting me, first and foremost, my parents, who gave my brothers and I every opportunity to succeed, and were great parents, and three older brothers that were role models in my own home, some great coaches and teachers and teammates along the way. But baseball today is something that I'm still very involved with, but it's a platform for me to share my testimony and to share what Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior, has done for me and done for everyone that would believe in him. But throughout my course of my playing career, beginning in college and then in the minor leagues, the post-game party or the nightlife and the partying lifestyle that I, you know, took joy in and pleasure in the early days ultimately led to an addiction issue that I battled for many years. And thankfully, 8.5 years ago, I surrendered. I gave my life to Christ. I have been sober and clean and forever forgiven for those poor choices I made when I was in bondage to alcohol and drugs. So it was a long journey, but one that I'm thankful I went through, even though I made a lot of poor decisions and was in bondage for many, many years. I'm a better man today for having gone through it. And now it is my calling to share my testimony, to let others know that There is freedom, and that comes through every personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and that is something that is so important to me, and something that I treasure and cherish, and want to share that with anyone and everyone that wants to listen, that is seeking freedom from addiction or any of the other issues that people deal with on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, as we all know, this country and this world's going through some very very difficult times right now. A lot of things are going on and swirling around us above and beyond the virus itself, and the evil that persists, and a lot of the pain and suffering that's going on. It just hurts to watch and hurts to see. But I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. I'm a believer in God and His plan for my life, and my faith is in Him to endure and persevere through all the trials in life. But it's obviously a very difficult time in our country, and it's really a lot of issues at play, and I'm just trying to do my part to help people find peace and comfort and peace and joy from the only source that it truly comes from, and that is Jesus.
It's an absolutely great story, and to hear, you know, how you did 8 years ago, you know, come to what you described in that whole thing you just said about, look, you know, the excess and the things that were available to you, especially playing in New York. You know, we talk about the 86 Mets a lot, and what is the first thing everybody brings up? They bring up the partying, they bring up the nightlife, just as much as they bring up the great plays on the field and the memorable moments. It's something that the team is itself remembered for. And that goes hand in hand with, that's not always a great thing to be remembered for, because outside of some of the excess comes addiction and comes struggle. And a couple of your teammates have also had the opportunity to share their testimony and kind of explain in the same way you did, you know, that yes, it's a great path at the time, but it's not always a successful path, and it leads you down kind of a dark path. So the fact that some of your teammates have also shared it, does it make it easier for you to be able to share your story, knowing that there's others that kind of have a similar path that you did?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Daryl Strawberry has been a great friend from the day we met, and certainly teammates in New York and in Los Angeles, and now we're teammates on Jesus's team, if you will. And Daryl's doing some amazing things in ministry and sharing the gospel and sharing his testimony, encouraging others, helping others. But when I saw Daryl at our 25th reunion of the 86 team, that was about 3 months before I finally surrendered. And I saw a different Daryl. I saw something in Daryl that I wanted. I saw a peace in him that I've never seen in him before. I mean, Daryl and I, you know, had some great moments on the ball field, and his stature in the game and his records and his talents and his superstardom far was outshone me, but yet we were still teammates, and we were battling some of the same issues during our career, and more so after our careers. And I saw him at a time in his life where he was probably 4 or 5 years to the good, if you will, and sober and clean, and was really in the beginning stages of his ministry. And it was about 3 months or so after that when I finally surrendered. So we've done some events together. We've shared our testimonies together. I've had him here in my hometown on a few occasions, and speaking at my church and speaking at various events and being a part of the minor league baseball franchise that I was instrumental in bringing to my hometown. Daryl has come and supported me in my efforts there. So he is one guy, and Dwight Gooden has had some major fallbacks and struggles last summer, but I've been encouraging Dwight and been in, really a positive voice in his life, and he's really made some great strides over the last year. He's had periods of his life since his career ended where he's been sober, but unfortunately he's continued to fall off every now and then. But praying for him and staying in communication with him and trying to encourage him. And there's been other guys on our team or in professional sports or in the entertainment field that have, you know, similar testimonies, but there's still an awful lot of guys and gals that are in those same professions and in every profession that are still battling, that are still in denial, that are still lying to themselves into thinking they don't have a problem, when in essence, the devil gets a stronghold on you through alcohol or drugs or whatever the case may be. I mean, it was a lifestyle of excess with the women and the partying and the drugs and the clubs and everything that was available to us in the 1980s. You know, it was hard not to get caught up in that. And there were some guys on our team that didn't. And obviously, Gary Carter comes to mind first and foremost. He was a Christian man, a family man that knew to a large degree what most of us on the team were up to on the road and at nights and after ball games. But he never judged anyone, never was critical of anyone. You know, he had that smile on his face and played the game hard and competed like all get out. You know, he was vilified for it. And looking back in hindsight, you know, I wish, and Daryl's been on record as saying such, and, you know, I wish others of us would have, you know, really saw what was truly making Gary smile, and that was his personal relationship with Jesus and his peace that he had and his passion for the game really showed through. And we all had passion for the game. We loved competing. We loved being a New York Met at that time. But, you know, many of us were distracted by all the bells and whistles and all the things that were available outside of the game in New York and everywhere we went. It was a wild time, and it was fun for a season, if you will. But ultimately, there are many of us that have suffered and struggled since then, and there's still a few, if you know who I'm talking about, that are still out there struggling. And I'm praying for them and hoping that, you know, they can find that same peace that's available to them through the man, Jesus Christ, the only perfect one that walked among us. And that has been something I've been very thankful to be able to share. And I appreciate you guys giving me the opportunity and the platform to share this tonight.
Absolutely.
And now, Barry, Doug here. One thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's been a couple weeks ago, ESPN came out with a press release saying that, you know, there's going to be a new documentary series coming out about the 86 team. Are you surprised that, you know, over three decades later that this team is so, you know, there's almost like a mythology around it. There's an obsession among fans to learn as much about that year as possible. And there's also, you know, a very strong brotherhood among the people that were there. Was that like anything you ever experienced in baseball? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, great question. Great lead in for sure. I played the game 14 years in professionally and 4 years in college. I've managed the minors. I've broadcasted. I've done a little bit of everything in baseball. And never was I a part of a team that was as talented, was as committed to the game, committed to winning, pulling for each other. It was a very special bond amongst not just the 86 team, but really the 84, it kind of began, and the 84 through 90 was some amazing years in New York Mets history, probably the greatest era of New York Mets baseball. We only won one World Series championship, yes, but, you know, it was a different time with two divisions and only the division winners going to the postseason, and we finished second every year we didn't win. And obviously, 88 with the Dodgers and the NLCS, we could have, would have, should have, you know, won that year, but did not. But yeah, there was an aura around that team then, and it still exists today. Mets fans, you know, that the Miracle Mets of the 69 season and what they did out of nowhere certainly is an amazing story. But the 86 Mets are the last Mets team to win the World Series. So that's part of it. But just the superstar players, Dwight, Darryl, Gary, and Keith, and then just some dynamic players in between. And then, you know, some role players and bench players and backup players, such as myself and Dave Magadan and others that still had good careers and were good ball players. It was quite a mix of guys that really bonded together. Davey Johnson, I believe, was a very underrated manager. He has people that really love him and support him and think he was a great manager. And like all of us, we also have people that didn't think he was that good. Maybe he was too lenient. Maybe he should have held, you know, held the players a little more, you know, to the fire, if you will. But his belief was, I'm going to treat you like a man as long as you, you know, respect the game, you show up on time, and you represent the Mets and in a very positive way. And unfortunately, you know, off the field, and thankfully, and it would never happen today with all the social media and camera phones and the antics that went on that were, you know, thought were really funny. And God knows there were some amazingly crazy times that were had by all of us. But you couldn't get away with that today. Yeah. And, you know, in this documentary, I'm sure they're going to glorify that to a large degree. But, right. You know, I hope they don't oversell it in that direction. You know, for all the craziness, there was also 25 or 30 guys with guys coming up and down, et cetera, 32 guys, 34 guys, whatever it was that were part of that team that season. We had one goal, and that was to kick ass. And we did that quite a lot, not just that year, but really for about a 5 or 6 year period. We were the dynamic team, but it's hard to win the championship. I mean, so a lot of people look at that team and say, and look at guys like Darryl and Dwight and criticize and say he should have been a Hall of Famer. And, you know, I get sort of aggravated sometimes when I hear some of those things said about my friends Darryl and Dwight. They were great players. They had great careers. Yes, they made some bad choices. Yes, they did some things that took away from their career and their Hall of Fame status, if you will. But nonetheless, they're humans like all of us. I would dare anyone to put themselves in Darryl or Dwight's shoes at 19, 18 years old in New York City and the world at your feet and see how you would handle it. But I love the guys. I love all my teammates. Obviously, a few of them are no longer with us. But great memories, great times. And I'm very, very thankful for my time as a New York Met.
And, you know, talking about some of these great memories, we can talk about a lot of aspects of the 86 season all day long. But, you know, you have probably one of the better minor league seasons in Mets history in 1985. You're driving over 100 runs, you know, great on base percentage, a lot of home runs. Can you talk about that last, you know, full season in the minors where you're, you know, everything's clicking? What was different about 85 compared to coming up through, you know, the first couple of years in the minors?
Well, that was certainly an amazing year and a great memory. And thank you for going there, if you will. But, you know, in the winter of 1984 actually is where I really – put myself on the map as far as the organization, where I was a Carolina League Most Valuable Player. I was an older Class A player and probably could have, would have, should have, even though I don't believe in those three words, been up at a higher level. But nonetheless, 84 is where I really knew after that season and the success I had that I was going to be a big leaguer one day. I didn't know if I was ready just yet, but I was going to be certainly moved up the, in the rankings of the catchers in the organization. But in December of 84, right before the 85 season, watching Monday Night Football at a friend's house, the trade for Gary Carter was announced. And that was a bit shocking and didn't really know quite how to react to it. But Gary proved obviously to be a missing piece and a great addition to the organization. Was a great player and was very instrumental player in the success we had in 85, 86, all the way through 89. But it pretty much put a roadblock on me. But in 85, Dave Magadan, Mark Carrion, Randy Milligan, Kevin Elster, Randy Myers, we had a great group of guys at Double A that year. And it was really a magical year for me. One, I was playing back in my home state of Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, which was a couple hours from my home on the Mississippi Gulf Coast in Biloxi. So that was a big time thing for me right off the bat. But we had a great team. We won both halves of the minor league season. We won the first round of the playoffs, and then we swept the championship series. And I had an MVP season, as you mentioned, 108 RBIs. I broke Darryl Strawberry's, actually, his RBI record. But and I still hold it in Mississippi, my home state. So pretty proud of that. But we had a great team. I did have an outstanding season. And then that off season going into 1986, I felt great about my chances to be the backup catcher for Gary Carter. But once again, like every year that I was there, I had three or four guys that I had to beat out every spring. That was John Gibbons, Ed Hearn, Greg Olson, Lloyd McClendon, and then myself. And thankfully, I won the job in 86. We actually opened the season, or the final exhibition game was in Jackson, Mississippi, against the Jackson Mets. And so my first official day, even though it was a spring training game, but my first official game with the Mets was in my home state at the Double A Park, where I had had a phenomenal season the year before. And had a busload of family and friends come up from the coast to be there for that. So great memories of that. So thank you for asking about that season. It was an amazing season. And that was what really catapulted me to become a big league player. However, being behind Gary Carter, a Hall of Famer and one of the great catchers of baseball history, did not afford me near as many opportunities as I would have loved to have had. But no regrets. I loved my time in New York. I enjoyed my teammates. I enjoyed the city. I enjoyed Mets fans. And still today, I go to Mets Fantasy Camp. I'm thankful to be invited to that the last 8 years. And man, what a joy, what a treat that is to be with 100-plus Mets fans and down in Port St. Lucie. And just memories come flooding back every year when I get down there. Putting that Mets uniform on again, there's nothing like it for me. I played for other organizations. I worked, you know, along with the Milwaukee Brewers organization. That's the AA affiliate that is here in my hometown that I'm an ambassador for and a broadcaster for. But the New York Mets is and always will be a special organization for me, and I'm cherished the time that I was able to be a Met.
It's an amazing time, but it's a fascinating time to see a catcher in the organization because, yeah, you see the acquisition of Gary Carter. So obviously, team-wise, it's much needed, and it's the missing piece to the championship puzzle. But you see, it's not just yourself. You know, in your whole tenure there, it was a backlog of catchers. It was amazing to see the catching talent that they had that, yes, Carter did have injuries as his Mets tenure progressed and he was aging and starting to get a little older. But then you add in guys like Mackie Sasser on the roster. You get a guy like Charlie O'Brien. And we were talking to Brooke Fordyce, who was drafted in 1989, who came in at a time where there was all of you guys ahead of him on the depth chart, so to speak, as a guy coming in. But also he had Todd Hundley and he had all the other Mets catchers that were being developed. So it was interesting to see that the Mets always had this backlog of catching talent that couldn't penetrate because they had a future Hall of Famer sitting there behind the plate. So is that something, what drives you at that point? Is it to be the backup or, as they call it, the caddy to Carter for his entire duration? You want to be right behind him?
Well, it was. And in 1987, I was the only backup with Gary. And that was a very good year for me. But in 88, about halfway through spring training, the Mets traded Randy Milligan to the Pirates for Mackie Sasser, right, left-handed hitting backup catcher. So that cut in any playing time for me. But it made our team better to have Mackie and his left-handed bat off the bench or catching, some of the games as well. So that took, obviously some playing time for me in 88. I did catch 50 something games that year, but only had 91 at bats. So a lot of times Mackie would start against some tough right-handers, and then we get to the sixth or seventh inning or late in the game. If there was a left-handed pitcher out there, I might get the pinch hit, and then I would catch the last couple of innings for defensive purposes. But nonetheless, Mackie had an outstanding career and was a dynamic hitter. Was a good catcher as well, but we know he had some issues throwing the ball back to the pitcher, which was hard to watch. I can't imagine what he went through, but I had my own battles in areas of my playing career that, it's tough. It's difficult. And when you're on that big grand stage of New York City and all the bright lights are shining on you, there's nowhere to hide. And if you have a fear or a doubt or have something in your game that you're not on top of the world confidence-wise, it can be difficult. And my last year in New York in 1990, I really struggled throwing guys out stealing, which we had difficulty doing that anyway.
Right.
But it really kind of came back to haunt me and it got in my head and doubt and fear set in. And that's a lonely feeling to be doubting your ability and playing the game not to make mistakes instead of playing the game aggressively and confidently. And it was a difficult time for me my last year in New York. But nonetheless, 88, we split time with Mackie, and 89, Gary got hurt early. I got a chance to play, was actually Mets player of the month in May that year, was really doing well, was really honing in on an opportunity to play more and more. And we were on a plane flight to Montreal in June of that year, and Davey Johnson didn't come to the back of the plane much, but every now he did, he came and he sat with Dave Maggin and myself, and this was when Gary and Keith were both, winding down, and myself and Dave were sort of the heir apparents, along with Mackie. But Davey had come to me and really expressed some confidence in me and sort of apologized for not being able to get me more playing time over the last 2.5 years. But, this is my time was coming, and lo and behold, the next night in Montreal, I get Pascual Perez fake bunts and chops down a foul ball, and it hits my big right big toe and breaks my toe. And so I was out a month. And anyway, Gary and I both came back at the same time in late July. And I ended up having a good finish to the season. And Mackie and I went into 90 sort of as a platoon, if you will, or I had the upper hand early, but Mackie ended up having an outstanding season in 90, and I ended up getting hurt and really having a tough time of it. But anyway, great times, great memories, New York Mets, baseball. I love it.
We'll give you a pass somewhat on the guys running against the catchers, because you did have to play the Cardinals a lot, and God knows Vince Coleman was running like crazy. So you guys kind of get a pass in that regard because of Coleman.
Well, that was a nightmare. I remember a commercial back in our playing days of Ricky Henderson, and where the catcher couldn't sleep at the night before or whatever, and was sweating bullets. I mean, that was me when we played the Cardinals. I mean, they had seven guys. Yeah, Vince Coleman was the leadoff hitter and the number one guy, but they had seven guys that could steal second base in a blink of an eye. And I think Vince Coleman had 56 consecutive stolen bases against the Mets until Mackey threw him out one day in St. Louis. Probably in 88 or 89, I think it was. That was the first time the Mets caught Vince Coleman stealing a base in 57 or 58 consecutive tries.
That's a whole team's stolen bases for three years worth of steals.
Such a different era. I would have loved to have been a catcher in today's game. My strengths coming up through the minor leagues was I was labeled an offensive player that, you know, was still a little raw catching. And by the time I got to the big leagues and being a backup player, I knew I had to get better defensively, and I did every year. And suddenly my label flipped on me. The big leagues, I became a really good defensive player. But I, you know, struggled offensively as a backup player, and playing once a week, it's not easy. So I didn't get to really perform offensively the way I believed I could have had I gotten more opportunities. But as I said before, nonetheless, I was thrilled to be a New York Met and will ever cherish those memories.
Yeah, absolutely. And how about working with a staff? And we won't even just specifically say the Mets staff, because obviously, you know, we've talked about the Mets a lot, but just managing a staff, you know, we'll just take it from the backup role. Like, how do you interact with a pitching staff and kind of get to know their ins and outs if you do have to get the call to get behind the dish and start taking, you know, some at-bats?
Well, that's another great question, another great lead-in, brother. That was something that I took a lot of pride in. I learned, I don't know exactly if anyone specifically taught it to me or if I just, you know, organically learned that the catcher's, you know, primary role, especially as a backup catcher, you've got to make the team not miss the number one guy defensively. What you do offensively is a bonus. The key is that I've got to go out there and operate that staff. And man, what a staff. I mean, I played the game a long time, and there's never been a better 1 through 10 or 1 through 9 pitching staff with four or five starters or four or five relief guys that we had. It was phenomenal. And those guys believed in me. They trusted me. And that's what you have to build and have to earn as a catcher, is to have those pitchers trust you. And I got along with all of them. My role, you know, there were some players, position players, that didn't like some pitchers, and some pitchers that maybe didn't like some position players. And, you know, a long season, not everybody's going to be hunky-dory and best buddies with everybody. We didn't have cliques and little separate groups like some teams that I've been on or some teams that I've heard of. Everybody was together, but yet not everybody was best of friends. But I was able to, as a position player, as a, you know, a hitter, and to really, you know, have a lot of great friends on the team. But also as a catcher, I had a lot of great friends on the pitching staff. And
right.
David Cone was probably my best friend during the years we were in New York. And Mark Carrion and Kevin Elster and some of the younger guys that came up with me or right after me were the guys that, you know, I hung out with the most. But Ojeda and Darling and Cone and Straw, I mean, you know, it was on the road, it was, you know, it wasn't 25 guys going 25 different directions. We stuck together. We were brothers, and we fought together. We hung out together. We, you know, we did a lot of things together, and then everyone would maybe slide off and go their own way later in the evening. But it was a great team, a great brotherhood. There was a special bond between us all, and even to this day, I just am so excited to see all these guys, and it's like no time has passed. We've been fortunate to get together about every other year for the last 10 or 12 years in some kind of reunion or memorabilia signing. The 86 team, until another Mets team wins, will be the last team to win the World Series. So I know some people probably get sick of hearing about the 86 Mets, but I had a small bit part in it, and I was there for the championship and there, but I wasn't in uniform. And, you know, looking back at all the highlights of the pylon on the field and some of the photos from the clubhouse, I was there, I was in it, but I wasn't in uniform. And, I, you know, as proud as I am of it, part of me still kind of, you know, is a little jealous that I wasn't in uniform and in the middle of all of that. But nonetheless, I was a member of that team and a part of that championship. And I take great pride in that. But the Mets, as I said earlier, during that era, is the greatest era of Mets baseball. But I still pull for the Mets. I'm still connected to the Mets in a lot of ways. And through Mets Fantasy Camp, I'm thankful I get to put not my old uniform, but the uniform that might be a size or two bigger today I put on for Fantasy Camp. But having that NY in orange on that blue hat or blue jacket or blue uniform, it does my heart good. I'm forever a New York Met.
We see that very familiar number 33 over your shoulder. So it's perfectly placed, if you will, for this visual aid. So as before we get into the wrap up here, I want to bring Doug back for a second. Doug likes to bring up some stats. I'll drop one. You said you guys like to fight together. Tonight's 34 years since the Ray Knight Eric Davis brawl. So we'll just leave that one off to the side. But Doug's going to come in with some Barry Lyons stats, and we're going to see if we can toggle some memory and pick some brain before we get into the wrap up.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
Now, before I get to that, Mr. Lyons, just one thing you said stuck out before. David Cone was on WFAN a couple weeks ago, and he said the same thing that you said about, you know, it might have been one of the problems why the team didn't become a greater dynasty, because they would all go to the same spot. He said it's the only time he's ever played where 15 or 16 guys were going to the same restaurant after the game, and, you know, kind of talking about the traveling circus aspect of it. And he thinks that, you know, one of the reasons why Frank Cashin broke up the team was because the team got too powerful personally, you know? So it's interesting you had that.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that. And, you know, I don't say that that's why we didn't win another World Series, but, you know, there are distractions there. You know, there are things that was going on that didn't necessarily enhance what we were trying to do on the field. But, you know, it was great times. It was a different time. The game has evolved in such a way. There's so much money involved. There's so much at stake. There's so much attention paid to every move that's made, both by the front office and the players, and during the game, before the game, after the game, in uniform, out of uniform. There's, you know, everything is front and center. Everything is documented and visible. So, you know, a lot of that fun was great, but ultimately it did distract and take from what was trying to be accomplished on the field.
And now getting into the Barry Lyons trivia portion of the evening, looking at some of your advanced stats over your career, I like asking guests, sort of what they remember about the specifics. So off the top of your head, do you know who you had the most hits off in your major league career? And I'll give you a hint that he's also one of two people who you had the most at-bats off of.
I look back at some of these things occasionally, but most hits, probably somebody in the Eastern Division, I would guess.
Correct.
Maybe Kevin Gross with Philly.
Kevin Gross.
All right.
Absolutely. And then also, so you had 14 at-bats.
Was later with the Dodgers.
Yeah. So you had 14 at-bats in your career off Kevin Gross. And now on the other end of things, you also have 14 at-bats against a guy who you struck out the most against in your career. Do you remember who that was?
Well, I bet he was right-handed.
One of the most underrated pitchers of the year, I think.
I'm having a tough time. Not sure.
So he struck you out four times in 14 plate appearances. Can you talk about facing John Smiley?
John Smiley, he was left-handed. He had a high fastball, running fastball with Pittsburgh. I don't know. I might have done okay against him. I don't recall lefties really owning me. There were a lot of righties that probably did. But John Smiley was an outstanding pitcher. He was a big, tall left-hander, and he pitched up in the zone more so and had a good breaking ball as well. So a lot of battles with those Pirates back then.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then last pitcher I want to ask you about, you went 3-for-11, a .273 average off of Greg Maddux. And a young Greg Maddux. What was it like facing Maddux during that period of his career?
Well, he was still Greg Maddux. He was a pretty good pitcher. He didn't just become a great pitcher when he got to the Braves. He came up a good pitcher and obviously got better and better. But he was, a young pitcher with the Cubs when I faced him. And as a matter of fact, I recall a couple of those hits. One of them gets some play on YouTube and videos. I had a breaking ball to right field that Hojo was trying to go first to third, and Andre Dawson threw him out at third base with a bullet from right field. And that was one of Andre's highlights. So I get a little airtime because of that. But it wasn't because of me. It was because of Dawson showing his arm from right field.
And now last question, looking at some of your year-by-year stats, that last year when you get back to the bigs in 95 in Chicago, you had a good offensive year and only about 70 at-bats, six home runs. Can you talk about that last time at the gate and what was different maybe about, seeing the end of your career at the plate versus the beginning?
Yeah, well, I tell my kids now that I was the best hitter I ever was as a 36-year-old last year. I mean, I learned how to hit later on. I mean, in the minor leagues with the Mets, we didn't have a hitting coach. Bill Robinson was our hitting coach at the big league level, and I love Bill Robinson, but he didn't spend a whole lot of time. He was also the first base coach. It wasn't like it is today, just put it that way. But Reggie Smith worked with me. When I signed with the Dodgers, they sent me to Arizona to spend 3 days with Reggie Smith, and he really introduced me to a whole different understanding of what I was trying to do as a hitter, and really, emphasized creating backspin, staying inside the ball, and really emphasized, staying through the right center gap, and it made me a better hitter, and I worked at it, and unfortunately, I went back to AAA for 3 years. I was invited to big league camp with the Astros, the Cardinals, and the Reds, and had decent spring trainings. But I was the odd man out, and so I'd go to AAA, and in case somebody got hurt. I was the insurance policy, or, you know, the other catcher struggled, and I just never did get the call back up those 3 years. So finally, I did get the call back after three really good years back in AAA and being a AAA All-Star and being a leader of the team on a AAA All-Star or a AAA championship in 1994, the year of the strike, which got a lot more attention than AAA normally gets because Major League Baseball was on strike and there was no World Series. But that last season with the White Sox, I got a chance to play when Mike LaValliere got hurt. And I really did well. I hit five home runs in a matter of 60 at-bats. I was DH-ing some. I was getting to play first base some. Terry Bevington was the manager of the White Sox that year. And Terry had managed against me in Double A way back in 1985. And he respected me as a hitter then, and he gave me a chance to play. And so finishing my career in the big leagues in 95 and having a really outstanding offensive season and very limited number of at-bats, it was a great way to close out my career on my terms. And when the phone didn't ring the next spring, I was able to walk away knowing that I made it back to the big leagues. I proved that I could play there again, and I went out on top, and that was something I cherish as well.
Let's not forget you also sent Tom Seaver into retirement, so that's another one for the record books too. So let's not downplay that.
Right. Well, that was another interesting story, and it's gotten a little play here and there. You know, obviously we wish, and I wish Tom the best. I know he's been dealing with dementia and has not come out publicly in a while, but to hear and read and rehash that time against Tom Seaver, it's great memories, and to know that at his retirement press conference, when asked who the toughest hitter he ever faced, with a smile on his face and probably his tongue sticking deep into his cheek, he did declare that Barry Lyons was the toughest hitter he ever faced. So with that being said, I tip my hat to Tom and appreciate that that shout out.
Can't beat that. So, all right, we're going to head into the wrap up here. And of course, you're listening to Diamond Conversations with Barry Lyons. Barry, I'm going to hand it over to you. So if you have anything you'd like to promote to the listeners of the show and have anything you'd like to share, this is your opportunity to kind of do all that right now. And I can't tell you how much it means for Doug and myself to have this time with you on our airwaves. But now it's your time to tell the listeners where they can find you.
Well, Doug, Ian, thank you so much. And for the listeners, I thank you for listening in and supporting their program. And I'm honored to be on it and be able to share a lot about my Mets career and some of the stories from those days. But once again, as I mentioned in my testimony, I'm a born-again Christian and a believer in Jesus Christ. And he died for me, and he died for all of us. And I just encourage people to seek and to open your heart and minds and ask Jesus to come into your life and be your Lord and Savior and develop that personal relationship with him. There's a peace and a joy that is beyond understanding that will help you through any and all the trials that life brings. And certainly we're going through some major trials right now. And I just ask you to turn to Jesus and let him carry you through it in Jesus' name.
Again, it's such an honor, and I appreciate you sharing everything that you did about your testimony and all the details of the struggles that you went through, but overcoming. And it's a great story of redemption. And again, just privileged to have you on and just give us a little bit of your time to go into that. So that's the wrap up for this show. It's Diamond Conversations. If you want to follow me, it's at Chad Ian B on Twitter. If you want to follow the producer extraordinaire, Doug, it's at Doug Barclay 17. And we will wrap it up for this week on Diamond Conversations. And we will catch you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following. Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.